96 now. Okay. Good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have this on the line right now. Bill Sardi. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Great to be with you, Dr. Stan. And, of course, always wonderful news to share in the world of health and nutrition and how to stay healthy.
All right, fine. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm just reading an amazing, amazing book, Seeds of Deception, Going into Genetically Altered Foods, and very, very similar to that book you sent me, maybe a year ago, Going into Genetic Engineering, Dream or Nightmare. But now this one comes out more like a nightmare. This is really frightening, and the tragedy is I don't think that most doctors, most people have any idea what's really going on behind the scenes, and the very real danger that we face from genetically altered food. We'll get into that some other evening, but right now, what would you like to talk about?
Well, certainly, I don't think your audience heard about, you know, my commentary about Bill Clinton. Of course, he had the bypass operation, and they said three of his four coronary arteries were pretty well blocked, 90%. And we'd like to point out to your audience that had Uncle Bill been given any kind of treatment other than surgery, you notice they used to treat people with medicines. Now they just treat them right away with surgery. And, of course, they took great credit for establishing good circulation in Bill Clinton, who was, of course, the prolific fast food eater of all time. And, of course, they're now blaming the problems that Bill had and his angina on the fact that he stopped taking statin drugs. Well, statin drugs may have nothing to do with angina whatsoever. It may have to do with the dilation and constriction of your blood vessels, not necessarily with cholesterol. And, of course, they've realized now more recently that there are other factors other than these blockages of the vessels, which they keep talking about. But they're trying to scare everybody back into, if you stop taking statin drugs, go back on them. If you're on them, certainly don't stop. And that's the number one thing. And, of course, we see all this. The British Medical Journal has taken to task the drug industry for what they call disease mongering, and that is they're saying that the drug companies are just hoping there's more disease so they have more products to sell. And, of course, one of them is the hypertensive drugs. And it says right here in a wonderful letter written by a British general practitioner in the British Medical Journal, he says, do people really want polypharmacy, that is, all these drugs to take, with attendant risks that, so that they are marginally less likely to die of cardiovascular disease and so marginally more likely to die of something else? Or could it be that the dependence of the multi-billion dollar drug industry on hypertensive drugs is stifling the debate? And, of course, you see doctors speaking out finally here a little bit. You don't see it in our side of the ocean, but you do see it here. There's a little unrest on the British side about all this taking these drugs, particularly the statin drugs. And, of course, more letters in the British Medical Journal explaining that there's no evidence for taking a lot of these medicines, particularly the blood pressure medicines. And, of course, we hear about this all the time. A doctor writing here that the British Health Services encourages unproved aggressive treatment. I'll just bet you thought that everything you get from your doctor is proven by science. If you want to really get the scoop on that, go to my website and you'll see my little ebook. You can download it and print it. It's free.
Hold up, off in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and I got so interested in what he was saying, I almost missed that break. But Bill was saying if you go to his website, and of course that's BillSardi.com, that's Bill, AskBillSardi.com. Go ahead, Bill, and tell them what they're going to find on your website.
Well, certainly, I mean, what we're trying to say is that conventional medicine holds its nose in the air and says we're science-based and everything else, the alternative practitioners and so on, and they have their own problems. They may not have good science behind them either, but they have no reason to hold their nose in the air. What we find is most of the treatments in modern medicine today are not backed by good science, and what we find is they're unproven or even disproven. And certainly when you look at treatments for hypertension, glaucoma, cholesterol, and so on, the most you can achieve out of taking cholesterol drugs is to live 6 months longer throughout your entire lifetime. 99 out of 100 users of the statin cholesterol drugs receive no benefit and will not reduce the risk of having a heart attack. Now, the doctor looks you right in the eye and says, your cholesterol's high, you need to take this drug or you're going to have a heart attack. Well, that's untrue. What they're showing is that there's a statistical, of course, prevention, you know, reducing the risk of a heart attack, but it's 1 out of 100. When you add that to millions of people, why then, of course, then they say there's all this great benefit and thousands of lives. Right now, they're just saying in the news tonight, 19 million more Americans need to be taking drugs for blood pressure. They say it will save America $4.7 billion, but we're going to have to spend $12 billion more dollars for the drugs.
And so who are they really interested in? Are they interested in the profits for the drug companies? Are they interested in, of course, avoiding coronary bypasses?
Well, of course, they subtract the cost of the care and say that, you know, when we look at the cost of the care, then we're saving money. But what I never see in these figures is the cost of the side effects of the medications. Now, close to about half of the people that go on the anti-blood pressure medications quit taking them. There's the terrible side effects. There's dizziness, impotence in men, and so on. They're just very uncomfortable drugs. And then the doctors, well, they're struggling with them because your blood pressure doesn't go down, and frequently they have to put you on 3 different medications in order to get your pressure down and keep rotating you because you keep having side effects from one drug to the next. If any one of them worked, you wouldn't need all of them. And, of course, some of these drugs beget the whole problem itself. That is, you'll never get out of the spiral of the disease. For example, anti-blood pressure drugs.
Hold that thought for just a minute, Bella. We Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and we're talking about, of course, the fact they want to get everybody under blood pressure medication. Now, when I practiced medicine, we had an adage, and it was your blood pressure would be your 100 plus your age, so that a person 50 years old would have a systolic blood pressure of 150. The 60-year-old blood pressure of 160 was normal. A 70-year-old would be 170, and that was normal. And then, of course, and you just didn't worry about the systolic blood pressure. Well, weren't able to have enough people taking their medicine, so they changed the criteria. And they hire scientists to prostitute themselves, to write scientific papers that will justify putting large numbers, and I'm talking about millions and millions more people onto antihypertensive medication. So before I had my hip surgery, I went in to see my internist, a very good man. I know him, and I know he is sincerely concerned about my health. But, of course, he parrots what he hears at medical meetings. He parrots what he reads in medical journals. And suddenly, my blood pressure should be at 120 now. My blood pressure, by my age, should be 170. But medicine has decided I should get it down to 120. And I have to start taking these medications, which have all sorts of side effects. And if you analyze the studies, which I did very, very carefully, you know, out of 4,000 people, I think there were 12 who were going to die if they didn't take the medication, and 10 died if they did take the medication, something of this sort. You know, and I looked at the alternatives, and I thought, what's going to happen if after having had a systolic hypertension of 150 since I was 25 years of age, I try to knock that down to 120. I think it's wrong. I think that there may be, if you got a systolic blood pressure of 300, that's an entirely different situation, or a diastolic blood pressure, you know, of well over maybe 100 or something like that. There may be some justification for it, but this whole idea of treating all systolic hypertension, I think, is really great for the drug companies. And some of our elderly citizens are putting out $500 to $1,000 a year, and we won't even let them buy the same drug from Canada at a cheaper price. Why? Well, because the government is here to help us and protect us. No, I think they're in the pocket of the drug companies. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, how long are we going to continue this giant fraud of not telling the American public that the biological action of virtually every prescription drug can be duplicated with dietary supplements, amino acids, vitamins, minerals, herbs? We can duplicate all those actions without the side effects and certainly without the cost. The public, of course, is uninformed. They have no idea of this. They're arguing for cheaper medicines across the border. Of course they're cheaper across the border. They're arguing that the drug companies, of course, are in an unholy alliance with the referees, the politicians, who keep fighting this. The FDA says those drugs may be watered down, they may not be safe. They're produced by the very same companies that we buy from, the Mercks and the various companies that we get all of our drugs from. They're made here and shipped over the border and then sold over there and, of course, sold back in here, but they're trying to tell us that, of course, they could be unsafe for some reason.
Now, the big thing is they say it's against the law for you to buy them. It's illegal. You don't want to be a lawbreaker, do you? And I say, look, the law is wrong, and you fellas in government should be investigated, because how many of you are getting kickbacks from the drug companies or bribes or going to work for the drug companies when they get out of the FDA? Or you come from the drug companies, you go to work for the FDA, and you change the regulations you profit your former employer. I mean, there is a revolving door between the FDA and the drug companies, and everybody knows it in Washington, D.C. But, of course, they're not going to tell you that, in the controlled media.
I frequently go on the air, on the radio, and we talk about the aspect of every drug can be duplicated with a dietary supplement. And I frequently get phone calls thereafter, and we just go through the list of the medicines that people are taking. And, of course, we try to reveal this on my website. There's no commercials there, askbillsardi.com. There are reports about cholesterol, high blood pressure, autism, on through. All kinds of reports there for you to read and understand. And, of course, it's all trying to tell you that there's lots of natural alternatives that, of course, are wonderful for us to tap into, natural antibiotics instead of the antibiotics that they keep promoting to us, which are synthetic. You have to go to a doctor to get them. they cost more, and they induce antibiotic resistance. That is, someday you may die because the bugs you have on board will not die or be killed by the antibiotics. So now you have resistant bugs, excuse me, and therefore you're going to have problems. So this is the kind of medicine we allow thousands of people to die every year, mostly in hospitals, because we give them antibiotics that only the drug companies are allowed to distribute, and yet we've shown in the medical literature that oil of oregano or fresh crushed garlic is equally as good at killing many of these bugs without developing any antibiotic resistance. The public is just uninformed. They have no idea. They think these things are marginal or because they're all natural or something, that they're not as good. And, of course, we just don't realize how strong. Someday the synthetic antibiotics are not going to work, and we're going to save all of humanity on these natural molecules that come from things like olive leaf and oil of oregano and garlic. Those are the things that are going to, of course, spare or save society. Garlic was always known as a poor man's penicillin. It was Louis Pasteur in 1858 who first showed in a Petri dish, a little laboratory dish, that garlic killed bacteria in a dish. It took 60 years later for Fleming to notice that a mold killed bacteria in a dish. They called it penicillin, and of course, they were off to the races with their prescription antibiotic drugs. It wasn't long, but within 1 year or two, that the bugs began mutating and resisting the penicillin, and of course people died because they were overexposed to those drugs eventually. So today, if you're going into a hospital and you're beginning to be given antibiotics, it's a very high likelihood that you're going to develop one of these antibiotic-resistant infections, and that's, of course, a double, triple, quadruple reason why hospitals today are a very unsafe place to be.
Well, there is a time when you need to go there, especially if you're going to have an orthopedic procedure. You can't, and some of these really are, will really relieve pain and restore function, but you really want to be careful of these problems we're talking about as well.
Well, someone once said that there's only three things that modern medicine can prove scientifically, and that is that it shows that it's science validates, certainly, the fixing of fractures or bones, the fixing of your teeth, and, of course, the removal of cloudy cataracts from your eyes and the replacement with a new plastic lens. Those three have been shown to be quite effective. The rest of medicine is struggling to prove that any of the current therapies are backed by any kind of science that will show they work in the long term. Now, some things are treatment. Some things delay the progression of disease, but they don't cure you. And in the case of, like, antihypertensive medications, they put a lot of people on diuretics. The diuretics are water pills. They wash water, but they also wash your sodium, potassium, and magnesium from your body, and the very nutrients that you need, potassium and magnesium, to make sure you don't get high blood pressure, are washed from your body, and you are totally dependent on the drug. And the second you go off of it, your blood pressure goes up even higher. You get scared and you go back on the drug again. So it's just a self-fulfilling drug. There's no way to get out of it unless you get educated to take some extra potassium and magnesium. They sometimes give you the potassium. They don't give you the magnesium. Worse yet is they have the potassium-sparing diuretics. These are drugs that now hold on to a little bit of the potassium, but sometimes they overdo it. The body holds the potassium, and you have potassium overload, and you die of it. And they blame it on the potassium, not on the potassium-sparing drug. It's amazing to me how they get away with this. They always point the finger somewhere else. And, of course, we're paying the price for it. To get back to Bill Clinton and, of course, his clogged arteries, we've been telling people for a long time that Linus Pauling was right about his vitamin C. Had Bill Clinton been given high doses of vitamin C, there's a number of people who still prescribe and who recommend a high dose vitamin C to clean the arteries out. And you can do a high dose artery flush with lysine and proline, two amino acids, and high dose vitamin C. Even the vitamin C will work by itself. I talked with a physician last week in Florida, and for the last 30 years he's taken 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C every day. And he recently went in for a calcium artery scan to see if his arteries had calcifications in them. They had to redo the test. they scared him a little bit when they brought him in the office and said there's something wrong, and then they explained to him that they've never had an adult go through the test who had no calcifications whatsoever. He had none, and of course they had to recalibrate the machine and do the test again just to make sure. And of course it shows you. And of course, why is that? Last week, the British medical journals reporting that 11-year-old children show early signs of having heart attacks and strokes later in life by the appearance of their blood vessels, and they were talking about the endothelium, or that is the lining on the inside of the blood vessels. What makes the lining on the inside of the blood vessels healthy? Of course, vitamin C, because it builds collagen. And when your blood vessels are maintained in a proper way with vitamin C, why then, of course, the plaques can't stick there, the calcifications can't stick to your heart valves. That's 1 out of 11 Americans have a mitral heart valve problem. Even the calcium can't stick in your kidneys. There's 1 out of 12 Americans have kidney stones. I mean, all of these problems, we wouldn't have all these calcifications if we would just get a few grams of vitamin C in our body. If we're perfectly healthy and not under stress, at least 2,500 milligrams a day and more when we're under stress or have disease.
All right, fine. Well, of course, the thing is that the government has been poo-pooing vitamin C for a long period of time, telling you you just don't want to take too much of that, totally ignoring the fact that animals produce their own vitamin C. It's only, what is it, human beings and fruit bats and one monkey
bird,
about four animals
that
don't.
Primates, right.
Right. And, of course, if you don't produce your own vitamin C, they're going to have to implement it if you want to maintain your health. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill Sardi and develop some more of these ideas on health issues, because there's so much that you can do to protect your own health if you know what to do. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. We're talking about vitamin C. We're talking about, of course, health issues. And Bill was saying that, you know, there is evidence in even very young children of problems with the arteries because there's damage to the endothelium. That is the lining of the blood vessel. But, of course, why would at that age they have it? Well, because they're not getting adequate vitamin C, because the human body no longer produces adequate vitamin C like every other mammal, other than one or two, the human beings, the fruit bat, monkeys, and what's the other one?
Oh, yeah, the primates and, of course, the guinea pig.
The guinea pig. Okay, well, talk a little bit more about that and how we can actually get adequate vitamin C, how much vitamin C you should actually be taking. And
well, people often ask me, why did God make it that I couldn't get enough vitamin C out of my food? God didn't make us that way. He made us to make our own vitamin C, and it was a protection. As we are under stress, we have adrenal hormones release sugar and fat into our bloodstream. Well, that means stress induces high cholesterol and high blood sugar. But the blood sugar would then go to the liver, and the liver would use enzymes to convert it into vitamin C. Imagine that. We'd never get diabetes because our blood sugar would become more vitamin C. That's how they make vitamin C today. They take corn syrup, the sugar, mix it with enzymes, and it comes out as vitamin C. So our body once had this protection. We have found the gene. It's a defective gene in our liver. It no longer makes the enzyme to make vitamin C, and therefore we are mutants. We are genetically defective humans. We once had this protection. Of course, we believe this justifies or verifies some of the biblical perspectives on why people live so long, because way in the past when humans did make their own vitamin C, it's possible that humans lived for hundreds of years. This made for unusual longevity when humans did make their own vitamin C. Now, in order for this genetic mutation to be transferred to all the rest of the generations, there had to have been some sort of a genetic bottleneck. That is, only a few humans left on the earth at one time in order for this to be transferred to everybody on the surface of the earth. We do find the Bible talks about a genetic bottleneck about Noah's flood. There were only 8 people left. Noah's family, that's when the genetic bottleneck was, and you'll see the genealogies in the Bible that Adam and Methuselah and Noah all lived over 900 years, and then the flood came, and thereafter the human lifespan went down to 600, 400, 200, about 120 years or so for Moses, and then on down to 70 years for David. So it was the perfect description of a progressive genetic mutation, and our inability progressively to not make vitamin C. And, of course, we'll have to get it all from the diet now. And even hunter-gatherers in early human days on the Earth were consuming 700 milligrams of vitamin C a day. We only get about 110 milligrams. So at least 100 million Americans in the United States have low vitamin C levels. And if they had the proper information, our government is misleading us and telling us we will not benefit by anything more than about 200 milligrams of vitamin C. We now find the government's own data reveals that this isn't true, and we at least need 2,500 milligrams or more. And if all of us took that much vitamin C a day, 100 million Americans with the lowest vitamin C levels would reduce their risk of cancer and heart disease by over 50%. This means...
Hold that thought, Bill, because we're going to have to bring our other stations on board, and then I will let you finish that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bill Sardi. Bill is saying that basically if 100 million people were taking massive doses of vitamin C, we would have massive reduction in the incidence of heart disease and cancer. And certainly, actually, Linus Pauling talked about this many, many years ago. He's poo-pooed. He was demonized. But Linus Pauling said it will help you as far as your immunity is concerned, cut down your incidence of disease and colds. He was even using massive doses intravenously and claimed excellent results. But, of course, he was demonized and attacked and vilified. And eventually, I think, you know, most people sort of forgot what he said. But only recently is evidence coming out to verify his position. And we have Ray calling us right now from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Did you have a question for Bill?
Yeah, well, I wanted to say two things. One thing, I've been taking 500 milligrams of vitamin C every day for the past 2 years or so. I guess that's not enough.
What they're telling us is that the half-life of vitamin C is 30 minutes. Half of it's gone in 30 minutes. So in order to keep the blood levels up, if you take that 500 milligrams every 3 hours or five times a day, you would keep the blood levels up so significantly that you would dramatically reduce the risk of the two major causes of death,
right?
That is cancer and heart disease.
Oh.
And, of course, you'd almost eliminate the risks, cataracts, aneurysm, gallstones,
right,
kidney stones. I mean, all of those would be eliminated, too.
Okay, anything else, Ray?
Yeah, I found out something really frightening about myself and medications. I've been taking Zyprexa for about, let's see, about 2 years now. I come to find out that because of the Zyprexa, I have a glucose level that's 120, where beginning diabetes is 125. So I've got a serious problem with, you know, having to lose weight and get off the Zyprexa, you know, which I am getting off. But I was really frightened by the whole thing, finding out that, you know, that Zyprexa caused diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is Zyprexa? You're going to have to tell me about that.
Pardon?
What is the medication you're taking?
Zyprexa.
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. Anything else, Ray?
That's it.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, Bill, why don't you go ahead and pick up the line of thought I had before I so rudely interrupted you.
Oh, no, it's fine. You know, if people will take that much vitamin C, again, the Annals of Internal Medicine earlier this year reporting that in the intravenous vitamin C, if doctors would employ it, they would achieve 160 times greater concentration of vitamin C than previously thought possible, and therefore vitamin C might or should be reanalyzed as a treatment for cancer. Oh my gosh, that's exactly what Linus Pauling was doing and telling us. They discredited him, and now they're rethinking this again. And of course, we know that cancer cells use up a lot of vitamin C. If they're given a lot more, they get healthy. So it's possible for intravenous vitamin C to be a cancer treatment. Not one of the news agencies in the world noticed this. We've written a letter to the Annals of Internal Medicine because that same study also showed that oral vitamin C could be, the concentrations could achieve levels in the bloodstream that three times greater than ever thought possible before. For the last 8 to 10 years, we've been living with the government telling us, don't take those high-dose vitamin C pills. They're worthless. You're wasting your money. You'll just have expensive urine. And now it turns all out to be a falsehood. They were misleading us. Their own data now shows that they've self-indicted themselves. But they're not forthcoming about it. They're not retracting their previous papers. They're not doing anything. We got 12 scientists in the world to confront the Food and Nutrition Board and demand that a new recommended dietary allowance be issued for vitamin C, and we're going to take them to task with more issues now as we find this anti-vitamin approach throughout all of healthcare, especially from government health sources.
Well, I really think there's a vendetta within the government against vitamin C, and really against vitamins and against so many things that are healthy for the individual. And you have to ask yourself, why would they do something like that? I mean, aren't they there to help us? And I would like to suggest that they are not there to help us. In fact, anybody who's read Alan Greenspan's speech last night before the Congressional Committee will realize he's saying there's just no way we can afford all these old people, and we've made all these promises for health care and for Social Security benefits. There's just no way we can possibly meet that, and we're going to have to be realistic. Well, what are you going to do with all these old people? Maybe you just don't tell them about things that might be healthy. Could that be? Would there be people that crass and indifferent? Well, I would like to suggest you read the writings of Jacques Cousteau in the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, where he talked about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. If you doubt that, you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy. There really are people who look at the world differently than rational people, but they are part of the elite. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Sardi, and he's been talking about the beneficial health benefits of large doses of vitamin C, which is relatively inexpensive. You can take, and you could take 500 milligrams every 3 hours during the day to get maybe 2,500 milligrams of vitamin C, and that would be a pretty good dose, wouldn't it, Bill?
Well, it's really humorous when you go into the stores anymore. None of the companies make 60 milligram, 100 milligram, 250 milligram. They don't make any of those vitamin C pills anymore. The public knows better. They don't make anything less than a 500 milligram pill. You can't find it in a drugstore anymore. But the government says any more than 200 is a waste of your money. Somebody's got it wrong here. It's almost comical.
Well, I think the people have a lot more good common sense than the government bureaucrats. Maybe, of course, they're looking up, people are looking up on the Internet. They're getting the information. And I think increasing numbers of them realize that the people who work for government really aren't defending the public. They're defending the drug companies, who certainly have no reason at all to want people to be healthy. After all, they were healthy. Would they be taking all the drugs that they're taking today?
Well, certainly not. We do get concerned about these issues, about whether they're really giving us the information to live longer and healthier. And, of course, we do see now headlines, United States prepares for another flu pandemic. What is the other one? Well, they're talking about that one in 1918. That was before we had sanitation, clean water. It was before we had vitamins and fortified foods. 20 million people died worldwide. Only a half a million of those were Americans. But nonetheless, they see a possibility here. If you're talking about reaching Jacques Cousteau's numbers there, his targets, why not just let a new flu pandemic scour around the earth? Oddly enough, Army scientists went up and dug out the genetic pattern of the flu virus of 1918 so they could figure out how to re-engineer and remake that one.
Why would anybody want to remake such a lethal influenza virus? After all, do you think you'd be happy it was gone, it wasn't there, it could never come back again? If they manufactured in a laboratory, is there any way it could get out accidentally, intentionally?
Well, it's really very odd that at the time when we now have the understanding how to engineer genetics, how we know how to do this now, when we've mapped the human genome and we're getting into the genome of plants and viruses, just when we have this understanding that somehow in history that viruses are jumping from animals to humans. It's never occurred before. Now, isn't that strange? They're telling us...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Bill. We take on our other stations right now. Well, I guess this evening is Bill Sardi. His website is askbillsardi.com, and Bill is making the point, and I think it's a very valid one, that down through the ages, there's always been a species barrier so that human beings didn't get animal diseases and viruses, and animals didn't get human diseases and viruses. Very, very rarely, a few things like tuberculosis, nudulent fever were spread from certainly cows to human beings, and rare forms of encephalitis, but there was very little spread from between species until they began doing genetic engineering, and they began actually finding means of actually forcing diseases from animals into humans and humans into animals. And now we're suddenly seeing this breaking out all across America. Of course, nobody wants to say, did genetics get out of hand? Have Dr. Strangelove or Dr. Frankenstein created a monster? And I rather think he has, but pick that thought up, Bill.
Well, certainly it's very suspicious that these animal viruses are jumping to humans, and you begin to wonder if they just didn't genetically engineer this and then blame it on the poor little birds and the other little animals. This just doesn't seem possible that these genetic mutations would be occurring just at this time. And of course, last year they told us a giant flu pandemic was coming. We were running out of flu shots. Run down there and get yours. It turned out to be that the government was in league with one of the companies that had made a vaccine that was, of course, inhaled, a little mist type that you got pushed up your nose. And so, of course, the government had all the other vaccine that they had to use up first. So they were hoping for a shortage of that everybody would run in and do it, and then they would run out of vaccine and have to buy it from this drug company, the flu mist, and then use that at a higher cost because there was no justification for buying something that was greater cost. And of course, that's exactly what they did, so they could bail out their buddies in the drug companies.
And what was even more unconscionable, Bill, was the fact that they made the vaccine for the wrong virus. In other words, the vaccine wasn't for the virus that was circulating across America. They knew it had toxic doses of mercury in it, and yet they were telling parents, oh, if you love your child, you're going to take them down. And some of these children were getting the equivalent of mercury that, well, for a 1,200-pound man, that would be the amount of mercury that if he weighed 1,200 pounds, that would be perfectly acceptable. And they're giving it to children weighing 10, 12 pounds. Why would you do something like that unintentionally? Well, because they had an agreement with a drug company that had manufactured that vaccine, that they were going to get rid of all of it, and they created panic across America. Oh, we're running out. Do you remember what happened in 1918? You better get your flu shot. There's only a few flu shots left. We're going to have to start rationing it. And they created a desire on the part of people to get those flu shots that if they had any good sense, they never would have gotten, because the government knew that maybe the vaccine for the wrong influenza virus. Let's go to Mike calling here from Santa Cruz asking about vitamin C. And our telephone number out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question?
The question with the vitamin C, which is, if you get too much, then you start to get the diarrhea, right?
Yeah, the body does give you a sign. Any kind of a cell that is stressed or sick needs more vitamin C. Now, if your cells don't need that much vitamin C, the body gives you a sign of that, and you'll get a little diarrhea, and it's called bowel tolerance. So how do you know which level to go up to? Keep taking it till you get a little bit of diarrhea, and then back off the dose, and that's where you know you need to be. By the way, for many people, that diarrhea is very transient, doesn't last long anyway, so... they try and scare us away from a trivial side effect, which is just the body's way of letting you know you've got enough. That's all there is to it. So, it was Dr. Cathcart in Northern California teaching us about bowel tolerance. Don't be afraid of vitamin C if you're ill. Keep taking it till you get to that point and then back off the dose a little bit. So you just need to learn the lessons. And any time there's a cell that has cancer or a virus or whatever's bothering that cell, it will need a lot more vitamin C. So that's just that simple.
Anything else, Mike?
So if you were, if say you were trying to treat cancer and you were trying to take a lot of vitamin C.
You would actually need intravenous vitamin C, which can increase the levels of vitamin C in your bloodstream by 160 times. We can do it by 3 times or 4 times better with oral vitamin C, but you can increase it even 160 times with treatment intravenously. But so if you had cancer, you'd do both.
But, Mike, here in California, no doctor can give that to you because it would be illegal and he would lose his license. So I hope that makes you feel better.
So it... no, that doesn't.
Okay, anything else?
Now, say you wanted to take a lot more vitamin C, and could you deal with the diarrhea by taking more water?
No, not necessarily. I mean, vitamin C does build up water in the lower bowel, and then that's why you have that. But you just back off the dose. The body's telling you have enough if you have that symptom, so back off the dose a little bit. That's what the sign is telling you. So.
Okay. Hey, we're going to have to run, Mike. We've got a board full of people calling.
Thanks
so much. Let's go to Phil calling from Michigan. Hi, Phil.
Hi there. A great program, Dr. Stan.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're listening.
Marvelous.
Tell all your friends back there in Michigan to start listening. Are you in Detroit or Flint?
Flint.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. On a previous episode, Bill, you mentioned about the toxic lawn chemicals being either oil or water soluble. So I'm wondering how do you know if walking a lawn where they sprayed these things along the school or the golf course or the park, whether it's safe to walk in it with your dog, your canine companion?
Yeah, he's talking about pesticides and herbicides, and of course we are concerned about them. They used to make them fat soluble, that is, so if it got in your system it would be stored in your fat cells and you wouldn't get rid of it. Now they realized there was a problem, they made them water soluble, so they do wash out. But there certainly is a problem where they do use these. And if you're, as he's saying, like you're in a schoolyard or wherever where they've used them, you can get exposed to it and not even know. So it does pose problems. Now, your body does have a wonderful way to detoxify itself of these in the liver, and guess what it needs to do that? Vitamin C, and of course, sulfur compounds like you find in eggs, garlic, asparagus, onions. And if you want to really detoxify your liver, concerned about it, you use a little dietary supplement called NAC. It's a little sulfur compound along with vitamin C, and then that'll help you detoxify your body and clean those things out.
Okay, anything else, Phil?
I just wanted to mention, Dr. Stan, that the flu epidemic of 1918, those who worked in the cinnamon shops never contracted it.
So. Isn't that interesting? Well, that's something that we'll keep up there in the files. Thanks so much, Phil. Let's go to Don calling from Washington. What part of Washington are you calling from, Don?
Moses Lake.
Okay, good to have you with us. Do you have a question?
More of a statement, I guess. I was taking men's one a day for some time. Bought in the big bottle of horse pellets. And I found that, I was getting sick probably once, twice, three times a year. And I stopped taking those about 2 years ago, and I can't think of a time when I've been under the weather since then. I have increased garlic in my foods. Also, cranberries, vegetables, my fruits and vegetables. I noticed that I've been sustaining healthiness without those extra supplements. Now, is there something in those supplements that...
Well, there often is, and we talk to people, particularly men, about iron being in vitamin pills. All of your bacteria, viruses, and funguses grow off of iron.
Well,
in an adult male, you don't want iron in your vitamin pills. It should be iron-free, and it will encourage infection. So you take the vitamin pills not realizing that. So you have to watch to have iron-free vitamins, particularly for males. Women do need iron because they're menstruating and losing it, but once they stop having a monthly cycle due to menopause or an early hysterectomy, then they need to be watching to have iron-free multivitamins as well.
Now, I'm in my early 30s, and obviously I want to, make it another 60 years or something. Is there any type of recommendation that you can give me as far as naturally foods that could help me sustain life and healthiness?
Well, people ask about foods all the time. The things that come to mind are the Mediterranean diet and, of course, the Japanese diet. You can read about those a little bit on my website. There's a wonderful book called The Omega-3 Diet by Artemis Simopoulos, who talks about the omega-3 oils and how they make people live longer throughout all the world. The Japanese are the longest living. And, of course, they eat the most fish, which has the omega-3 oils in it. The Eskimos gave us lessons from the 1930s, and were consuming as much as 13,000 milligrams of fish oil a day, and hardly had any noticeable disease whatsoever.
Wow.
So those are good lessons for us, but the remarkable discovery is, in the past year, is that we can work very hard at living longer and healthier. And if we maintain our cholesterol, we'll live 6 months longer. If we exercise every day, we'll live only a year and a half longer. If we eat a vegetarian diet, we'll only live 4 to 7 years longer. If we're women, we don't have the iron overload early like men do, so women outlive men by about 5 to 8 years. But if we restrict our calories, something most of us are not going to be able to do, but if we severely get down to about one meal a day, about 1,100 to 1,500 calories, we eat 3,700 calories a day in America, then we would add 30 to 50 years of healthy living to our lives. Now, there's a way to cheat, take a shortcut to that, and it's called red wine molecules. It was discovered really by the French. The French paradox, the fact that the French eat all those calories and rich cream sauces and don't pay the price because there's some, well, miraculous molecules inside that red wine they drink. That's all been, of course, now concentrated into red wine pills. I played a role in actually developing and one of these things. The product is called Longevinex. These red wine pills mimic what calorie restriction does. Gives your cells time to repair their DNA and virtually wipes out all disease. A red wine pill, if it lives up to its calling, would completely eliminate the need for doctors and medicine. You would not need high blood pressure pills, cholesterol pills, insulin, or diabetic pills. You would not need antibiotics. And, of course, the longest living people on the planet that have lived, Jean Calment in France in modern times, lived 122 years, was a wine drinker. Antonio Todd lived 115 years on the Isle of Sardinia, drank 3 glasses of red wine a day. We tracked all this down. These molecules, you might say they're magic. God put them here for a good reason. We now have, of course, a way to get them without the alcohol, the calories, and the sulfite preservatives.
Yeah.
I helped develop a little pill called Longevinex, and you might want to look that up on the Internet, L-O-N-G-E-V-I-N-E-X. And before we're finished, we're going to tell you the wonderful story of Conrad Roland, a man who's 70 years old in Hawaii who began taking these red wine pills called Longevinex. He had had a previous heart attack, an abnormal heart rhythm which disappeared when he began taking these pills. His blood pressure normalized to that of a 10-year-old. His good HDL cholesterol went up to 94. It's unheard of. Men never get better than 40 or 50. The good cholesterol that trucks the cholesterol out of your arteries. He also had skin cancers all over his skin. Those disappeared. He had a toenail fungus, which disappeared. He had recurrent lip sores from herpes. He's never had an eruption since. And he even began growing dark hair again. He sent us a picture. He had totally white gray hair as a 70-year-old. It's coming back in as dark hair, just like when he was 20 years old. It's an astounding story. It won't happen for everybody. But if you want to learn the lessons of longevity in red wine, you'll want to look into the story about Longevinex.
Do you want to put out a telephone number on that one, Bill?
For people who want more information, 866-405-4000, 866-405-4000, Longevinex, or Longevinex.com, L-O-N-G-E-V-I-N-E-X.
Okay, we got to run that. I guess, Ari, did you have a question?
Yes, I do have a question. I had bought some inositol. Did you write that it's helpful for reducing iron? Is that right?
Inositol, it's IP6, rice bran extract. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how much should I be taking a day?
I see. Well, if men who have iron overload, or in middle age, most men do, want a chelator to remove it, and they should take a couple thousand milligrams a day with water first thing in the morning on an empty stomach, and do that for 30 to 60 days, and they'll clean out their liver and gallbladder and arteries of calcium and iron deposits that have accumulated over their lifetime.
Okay. Another question I have is, sometimes I try to look up medical journal citations online, and I was wondering, what is the best way to do that?
Well, you can go to a website, the National Library of Medicine, which is called PubMed.com or PubMed.gov, PubMed.gov, G-O-V, like government. So the difficulty is that when you're searching there, you do need a little backgrounding on how to understand the scientific articles, but that's where you find it.
And it's all free in the full text of articles?
It's absolutely free. You can search the National Library of Medicine yourself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Let's go to Paula, who's calling from Spokane. Hi, Paula. Are you having a problem with vitamin C?
Yeah. Well, I've taken it for years, and lately I had difficulty peeing because taking it because I think I burned my stomach with hot liquids because I broke the pot that I boil water for tea, and I just used a regular pan, and the water got so much hotter. And is there anything that would heal the stomach and make it not so reactive?
Yeah, you don't have the mucus lining there now, and you may have a little scarring. So go to the form of vitamin C that's alkaline rather than acid, rather than ascorbic acid. Get what they call the mineral ascorbates. These are the buffered vitamin Cs. That's what you ask for. And they'll have an alkaline mineral in there. That'll make it easier on your stomach. And then try to get the stomach to heal up better. You'll need vitamin C to help it heal, a little bit of zinc, and maybe even give yourself a little bit of the NAC that I talked about earlier, NAC, in order to try and get your mucus lining to heal up on your digestive tract. Vitamin A is good in that respect, too, but you don't want to overdo vitamin A or take it for long periods of time. But you just have some scarring and a little bit of area that needs some help, and the more acidic your vitamin C is, it's upsetting your system.
What is the dosage for NAC?
NAC, up to 500 milligrams a day. You can't overdose on that, really.
Okay, anything else, Paula?
Where do you get your oil of oregano?
Oil of oregano, the best brand that I've found is North American Herb and Spice Company. They make it in liquid. They also have it in capsules. And oregacin, O-R-E-G-A-C-Y-N, is the most potent oil of oregano capsule made by North American Herb and Spice. You can find it online in health food stores and elsewhere.
Thank you very much.
Okay, fine. Thank you for calling, Paula.
Bye.
Well, we've got John calling from Spokane. John, I have a question. We'll have to put it off until we take the break, but what's the question?
Yes, sir. You mentioned hyaluronic acid, Bill, and the vegetables that are grown in Japan. Are you aware if they're marketing those in the States or if they're available for farmers?
All right. Yeah, well, now, you're going to have to hold because we're going to have to go to break here.
All right.
Some of our listeners will not actually hear the answer. Well, they'll have to get the tape if they want it, but we'll be back here in just a moment, and we'll answer John's question, and then we'll have to let Bill Sardi go. But it's been a fascinating hour, as always, having Bill on our programs. Always a real pleasure, and it's amazing how those lines from all across America light up. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, John, you wanted to know about hyaluronic acid?
The vegetables, are the vegetables grown in the States? Are they available anywhere?
Actually, I'm just back from being there. When I was there before, it was just kind of a whirlwind half-a-day tour. This time, I paid for translators and advanced people and all that. We got a better picture of what's really going on there. So what escaped the ABC News reporters when they visited there before, they thought it was due to sticky vegetables and so on, which we could see there. We ate them. But plants don't have any HA in them. They have cellulose. And, of course, hyaluronic acid is only made in animals. It's a water-gelling molecule. And what the Japanese are doing is getting estrogen-like molecules. Notice when women are pregnant, they have estrogen levels that are high, and their skin is full and luscious. Their hair is thick and so on. They have high hyaluronic acid levels when they have estrogen, and the Japanese are mimicking that with their plant foods that have phyto or plant estrogens in them. They get it in their soy, particularly their miso and their miso paste. They have a little purple sweet potato there that has natural phytoestrogens in it, and that was the secret of that little village in Japan called Yuzurihara, where the people look so young for their age. And, of course, we went back. That report is online at my website, AskBillSardi.com.
Anything else, John?
Well, we probably don't have the time to get into it tonight, but Blaylock is talking about miso and soy as being an excitotoxin, so I guess I'd opt
the soy they're using there is, you're being scared by the soy bashers, but the soy is is fermented, and it's in a paste like miso and so on, and that's what makes it really work.
If you could post the Latin on that purple yam, I'd like to know what species that is. That'd be worth treating.
Well, I have some here at home. I'll see if I can't find it out for you.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks so much, John and Bill. I want to thank you again for being with us. Our guest this evening has been Bill Sardi. His website is AskBillSardi.com, and certainly Bill is one a faithful supporter of Radio Liberty, and we appreciate his being willing to come on to our programs on a regular basis and educate our listeners. And I have to tell you, we get an awful lot of people who actually write in and say, we really want to hear Bill Sardi again. Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, we enjoyed it. We'll hope to come back soon.
Oh, you will be next month, and then, of course, Bill will be appearing, be one of the guests on our program we're putting on here in Santa Cruz on the 6th of November on the North Shore of Monterey Bay at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and Bill will be here, and he'll be putting on one of our talks. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night, and God bless. Okay, fine. That was Bill Sardi. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us so we can continue doing what we're doing, and this program is heard on 10 stations plus shortwave, actually two shortwaves out frequencies and on the Internet, but being on the radio and having to buy radio time is an expensive proposition, so we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out on many subjects, but I think health is a very important subject because I think if you read my newsletters, if you analyze what we're talking about the fact that there are people within government and within the elite who really don't want so many people on the earth, people like Jacques Cousteau, who talk about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. People like Bertrand Russell in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, published in 1953, talking about putting things into food and, of course, into the water that will cause people not to live so long and not to be healthy. And only the very elite, the 5%, will be allowed to reproduce. Everybody else will be sort of like a drone. These are his words, not mine. There is an elite. They rule the world today. And if you read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or see the video or get the audio tape, you'll begin to be introduced to what motivates these people within the elite. It's not imaginary. It's really very real. You can go back and you can read the writings of Woodrow Wilson in his book, The New Freedom, published in 1913. We'll send you the pages, if you'd like, because it's out of copyright, where he talks about, since I entered public life, some of the most important men in the country have come to me, and they're afraid of someone, they're afraid of something. And they know there's a force out there so powerful, so consuming, so all-embracing that they dare not speak of it above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. Or the letter I found when I went through Colonel House's papers at Yale University that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had sent to him saying, as you and I both know, there is a financial element in the centers of this country that has controlled our government since the days of Andrew Jackson, and I'm not completely excluding the regime of WW, referring to what Woodrow Wilson. And there really is a force out there, but until you understand it's a spiritual force and what energizes these people is organized evil, you can't understand anything that's going on. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the survival of civilization and of humankind. So please, if you would like to get our copy of our newsletters, why, give us a call. We'll send you our latest newsletter, which will tell you what's happening financially and what Warren Buffett and what Alan Greenspan really think. Call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Maybe if you would like the copies of those quotations from Woodrow Wilson, the pages out of his book he wrote in 1913, or the letter that President Roosevelt wrote to Colonel House. We have all of the documentation. We try to have documentation for everything we say because, well, it is just too incredible. So we ask you then, of course, to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Tell others about our programs. Encourage them to listen, to support our efforts consider seriously coming to our November 6th meeting, which is going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And that's going to be on the evening of, pardon me, all day long on the 6th of November, Saturday. And if you can come, there's going to be lunch served. It's going to be an all-day program. I would hope that you'll want to call and make reservations now. We're beginning to get a pretty good sign-up on that. And, of course, we are having people from all across America, and we're hoping to have, of course, people throughout the world as we have in the past. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you have not yet seen the video, they sold their souls for rock and roll, the 4 or the 10-hour version. You need to get it to understand, as you hear these people in the music industry talking, how they sold their souls to the devil. Much of that is the same music you're going to hear in our churches today. If you want to get the 4 tapes out on the Church Growth Movement or Diapract, give us a call and then pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line the editor of World Affairs Brief, Joel Skousen. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. It's always a privilege to be on Radio Liberty, one of the shows that I consider the shining beacons in the alternative news media.
Well, thank you so much for those kind words. Well, I'd like to say I'm always pleased to have you with us, too, because you always have so much to offer. What are we going to be covering this evening from World Affairs Brief?
Well, in line with your very timely comments about illusion is king and reality is scoffed at, I think we need to discuss a little bit about the Breslin school hostage crisis in Russia and how this is being used once again to justify continued oppression in Chechnya. It's taken a long while to sort out the facts of this hostage crisis, which took place in the north Ossetia region of Russia. This is bordering Chechnya. And the controlled nature, of course, of the news coming out of Russia is a prime factor in obscuring the truth about this crisis. The Russians really were holding back information. This week they even admitted they lied about the gravity of the hostage crisis. The government has released some pretty gruesome footage of what happened during the what I consider a botched rescue attempt. Certainly, some heads are going to roll militarily if you can't pull off a better rescue attempt that results in over 300 deaths and 700 out of the 1,000 are wounded. I mean, that's a pretty bad rescue attempt compared to what the Israelis are able to do. Pretty messy, and to be frank. But putting aside for a moment, you know, the great tragedy, Dr. Stan, and the loss of innocent human life, we cannot overlook the fact that this incident is being used by Russia to once again justify increasing oppression and assertion of control over Chechnya.
No, don't you think it's also being used to expand a government power within Russia itself? And we're finding now the Russian people are losing more and more freedom in the name of fighting terrorism, almost like the American people are losing their freedom in the name of fighting terrorism.
Well, it is interesting that the Russians have used more of the American approach of Hegelian conflict to justify. They used to be, you know, they just put out an edict to say we're taking over this or that, and the people knew there was nothing else to do. But now that they are pretending to democracy, just as our own globalist controllers and our government are pretending to some form of democracy, the Russians are playing the same game of creating a crisis in order to justify clamping down on what, at least the appearance of liberty that has been there since the 1990s. Putin just recently changed the electoral form of governorships there in the Commonwealth of so-called independent states to appointed ones. But as even pundits in Russia have pointed out, this has very little to do with the Chechen hostage crisis and wouldn't, in fact, have created or prevented that in any sense of the word. So it's a case, as you say, of using the appearance of terrorism to justify an increase in totalitarianism. And I think that's where we're headed back in Russia. It is a carefully crafted deception, and so they're using every excuse they can to get back to a Soviet model before they launch a new war against the West, which surely will come.
Well, of course, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me, although it really shouldn't, but Putin is talking about he reserves the right to a preemptive strike, a preemptive war for anybody who is harboring terrorists. And then he points out that America is harboring many of the terrorist leaders of Chechnya. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and we're talking about this hostage crisis, the tragedy, but really, of course, is it as we assume it is? Is this being used to establish the justification for a preemptive nuclear strike by Russians against those people who are financing the terrorists? And of course, Putin has suggested that the United States and Great Britain are both have been helping the Chechnyan rebels. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Well, yes and no, Dr. Stan. What's interesting in the Chechnya conflict is that there are legitimate freedom fighters in Chechnya who really do hate the Russians and who are trying to overthrow them, and then there are KGB-controlled freedom fighters, that is, or terrorists, who especially do their best to blacken the name of the Chechen freedom fighters. For example, these were the terrorist leaders who would target Western journalists, and we now have those that operating under KGB control firebombed several apartments in Moscow a couple of 2 to 3 years ago, and now I believe have pulled out this Breslin hostage crisis.
You really think this may very well have been an agent provocateur situation?
Well, we have to consider it, since there is so much evidence that the SFB, the follow-on to the KGB, secret police there, used agent provocateurs to do the apartment bombings in the name of Chechen freedom fighters. In this case, of course, it's still unclear whether the hostage takers were real terrorists or hired thugs. But one suspicious fact was that several of the dead hostage takers were Arabs. And while the world is quick to assume a link to the mythical Al-Qaeda, whenever you have Arabs present, there's ample evidence of Arabs being hired by Russians for assaults around the world. So it could go either way. Another indication that these were not indigenous Chechen freedom fighters is that the intercepts of communications from the school went to outside controllers in other parts other than from Chechnya. So it indicated that there was external foreign control over these particular terrorists. Now, that may have well, since it came from the Russian intelligence services, be disinformation as well. So there's a lot that we really can't say, but as long as the Russians have a track record of using agent provocateurs to blame the Chechens for so many incidents, we cannot say definitively that this was a real terrorist attack. Now, one of the things that makes me suspicious as well is the fact that this rescue attempt was so bloody. Now, the U.S. have, or the Russians, of course, have special forces that rival the training of anything the U.S. has, and even is similar to what Israel has. So
hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Joel Skouse, and he's pointing out that, of course, there's a serious question as to what really did happen at the child hostage, and, of course, that the Russians have some very highly trained special forces. So if they have highly trained special forces, people who are as well trained as the Israeli special forces and the American special forces, then why did things go so wrong unintentionally? And so pick up the story from there.
Well, it's very obvious to me that they didn't do a surgical strike. They didn't use stun grenades or other things that would have caused non-lethal casualties in the hostage crisis, as the Israelis do. You know, to have 700 wounded out of 1,000 or 1,200, I mean, that's a pretty high capacity. They simply must have let these hostage takers go ahead and shoot. But, you know, smart hostages terrorists really don't want to blacken the name of their own movement so much. They want to target a few, but to have this kind of indiscriminate killing doesn't serve their purposes at all. So all of this doesn't speak for the fact that these were real Chechen freedom fighters. But as I say, we don't know for sure.
Well, one of the stories I heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, but apparently a couple of the terrorists, or whatever they were, objected to what was going on with the taking the children as hostages, and the leader of this group supposedly just shot them right down to bring all the other people under his command into line. Now, that would suggest that maybe these people had no idea what they were really getting into. Maybe they thought it was something entirely different than it turned out to be.
Well, this has historical precedent as well. We find often agent provocateurs will infiltrate and use legitimate patriotic freedom fighters to back most of their operations. But when it comes to betraying the operations, you know, then we have those leaders turning on their own people, because the leaders obviously don't belong to the same camp as they do. The UK Observer had a few interesting things to say about Chechnya and terrorism in Russia, and I'd like to quote a little bit from that. They say, and I quote, "Putin's policy of draconian crackdown and his failure to even countenance a limited degree of self-determination in some parts of the Caucasus, meaning Chechnya, has been a policy doomed to fail." Now, this is true. What's pretty strange, you know, if you want to pacify a region, and that's what's happening in Iraq as well, you really give a great deal of deference to the people. You try to make friends. You try to make every concession that you can possible, even though you do have to target those people who don't want any involvement with their overseers. Nevertheless, when you have a policy of total control and you squelch any form of self-determination, you know that policy is destined to create antagonism rather than peace. And that's what's happening in Iraq with the U.S. policies. That's what's happening in Afghanistan. And that seems to be what's happening with Putin's policy of draconian crackdown. So he, in essence, becomes a de facto recruiting sergeant for terrorists. In other words, he creates more terrorism, just as the U.S. is creating more terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan by the obvious hypocrisy of what they're trying to accomplish there.
And then that's really very interesting. And of course, as we see this war continuing in Iraq, we're not making any friends there at all. We're not pacifying the people. There's more violence than ever before, more Iraqis being killed, more Americans being killed. How could you do such a poor job unintentionally?
It was very interesting also to turning to a little bit about Afghanistan and what may be false motives there. General Tommy Franks gave a very interesting interview where he said that he was quite shocked to find out that even before, just after Kabul was taken in Afghanistan, the U.S. started to move out troops and intelligence personnel in preparation for the war in Iraq. Now, that was months before anyone said that there was an excuse to go after Iraq, even months before the U.S. was rattling its sabers around Iraq. This is very, very good evidence from Tommy Franks, the commanding general of Southern Command, who was in charge of the Afghanistan operation, that they, in fact, the Bush administration already
was intending to attack Iraq even before they made that public.
In fact, wasn't that from Bob Graham, Senator Graham's new book
that's
just coming out, right?
That was. In fact, I was listening to Bob Graham on NPR, a pretty slick operator, actually. He's an insider who's obviously covered as part of one of the Senate Intelligence Committee members. He's covered for a lot of the problems in our intelligence. And yet he knows enough to come out on the side of the critic of the Bush administration and as part of the 9/11 Commission. He had some very interesting things to say, but he was extremely, evasive when it came to roles that he played. For example, I remember, and this was on the Diane Rehm show, either yesterday or today, one of the callers, savvy callers, called in and said, what about you meeting with Pakistani General Mahmood, who was the ISI chief, right before 9/11.
He was financing Muhammad Atta.
Right. That was brought up, too, that he had financed, given $100,000 to Muhammad Atta. And it's very interesting. It's obvious that he was prepared for this question. He knows that it's been circulating on the Internet, and he had a very questionable but reasonable to the unassuming person, an excuse. He said, the ISA, of course, has had ongoing relationships trying to infiltrate al-Qaeda, and this was one of their ways of paying off one of the al-Qaeda members in order to maintain contact. That was his excuse. And, that sounds very logical, but it doesn't take $100,000 to do that.
And, of course, why would Muhammad Atta take $100,000 and then commit suicide? That doesn't quite make sense.
It doesn't, but it shows that these insiders do have logical sounding excuses that can get heads nodding as they respond to these types of things. In any case, going back to each of these major hotspots, there's some common things here. One, Russia's playing the al-Qaeda card with Chechnya, taking every opportunity to link Chechen freedom fighters with al-Qaeda to be able to brand them with a terrorist name. The same thing's happening, of course, in Iraq. The United States continues to try to make the case that Iraq had ongoing relationships with al-Qaeda. This is not very rational, considering that al-Qaeda is supposedly a fundamentalist organization, a fundamentalist Islam, and Saddam Hussein ran an anti-fundamentalist campaign, a very secular regime. So, it just doesn't make sense. You can't have it both ways. You can't claim that al-Qaeda is one thing and then breaks their vows to deal with the infidels in the other way. You can't claim that al-Qaeda is the biggest, most powerful organization in the world of terrorists, and yet they've not been able to pull off any simple, normal terrorist attack in the United States. And I don't consider 9/11 a normal terrorist attack. That was high profile. Normal terrorism is simply car bombings or suicide bombings or bombing of electrical infrastructure, of which we have no defense in. And if they can't pull that off, with a budget not exceeding a few thousand dollars, how do they pull off something as sophisticated as 9/11, which involved explosives throughout the World Trade Center towers, especially in the basement around the 42 main supporting pillars, huge pools of molten metal in the bottom of that. It's one thing to hijack an airplane. It's another thing to have sophisticated electronics installed on that airplane, pods and modifications made to it, as we've seen in the videotapes, and explosives in the buildings. I mean, we're not talking about 19 hijackers, of which 7 are still alive. We're talking about hundreds of insiders within government and business that can carry this off, and yet they can't do a single suicide bombing in the United States? This is just illogical. I'm not buying it.
Well, I think that more and more people are not buying it. As you know, the Zogby poll in New York recently showed that 50% of the people in New York thought that the government knew about the attack and allowed it to happen.
Yes, and when you ask the very difficult questions, of course, about aircraft modification, and when you realize, if you know anything about how the FAA and the airlines deal, that you cannot modify aircraft, drive it up the flight line, have all the maintenance personnel check off and have this big bulging modification on the bottom of one of the airliners. You just can't have it happen unless someone's officially in government covering and saying to people, disregard, this is a certified modification, you're not supposed to tell anybody or ask any questions. I mean, there's no way this could happen without government collusion. That's the point that I'm making. It could not have been done by terrorists.
I think it's a very, very valid point. Okay, is there anything else you want to talk about as far as Chechnya is concerned?
No, I'd like to move on to the Bush-Kerry election contest. Also on making the rounds of the public radio stations were all of the pundits talking about how much negative campaigning there are. One of the most fascinating interviews over a couple of the experts came on and told Diane Rehm, they said, look, Diane, you know, we're experts of the field. The reason people run negative campaigns is that it works. People listen to negative. The human mind is built to see contrast. It's built to see negatives. It's not built to see everyone spouting off positive things about what they think they're going to do. People assume. There was one pollster who got on and said, yes, I can confirm what this other political expert is saying. Even though our polls always say that people come out and say, I'm against negative advertising, they in fact like it and listen to it, and it does affect elections. And she asked him, how do you explain that dichotomy? Well, very simply, it's politically correct to say, I'm against negative advertising. When you beat on that drum long enough at the press, people are going to say, oh, no one's going to admit that they like negative advertising. But in fact, that's how they learn, and it does affect the campaign.
And I think, of course, it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. A recent article by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who's certainly one of my favorite columnists, suggesting that if President Bush and George John Kerry really understood what was going to happen, they wouldn't be competing to see who's going to win. They would be vying to see who could throw the election, because as he pointed out, it doesn't matter who gets in. The way things are looking economically, why the next administration is going to be a total disaster economically as the economy begins to collapse. I thought it was a fascinating idea that they really ought to be vying to see who could throw the election rather than who could win it. We'll be right back here with Joel Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Joel is talking about what's going on, the negative campaigning going on in the election. John Kerry pointing out to Bush's military record, people who are supporting Bush pointing to Kerry's military records. Pick up the story there, Joel.
Before I go to the actual mudslinging on these two issues, I want to pick up on one of the things that you ended with Paul Craig Roberts' comment. While it is very true that the fundamentals of the economy are still crying for a movement into a downward direction, for example, EDS, the major insider-connected government, it's a private corporation that does mostly government work and big corporate work, Ross Perot's old company, is laying off almost 20% of their workforce or cutting $3.1 billion in expenses, 20,000 people, and we're supposed to be in a recovery. In fact, it is a selective recovery. There are areas of the economy that are still going down. Major corporations are still doing a great deal of belt tightening. But in fact, there is a great deal of money flooding the economy because of government deficit spending. So the economy really relatively is awash from the high-end people, from the people who have access to government money, but those that don't have access are really suffering from the inflation caused by this flood of money hitting the economy. Now, I am not convinced, frankly, even though the fundamentals cry out for a recession, for a contraction of the economy, I'm not convinced it's going to happen, mainly because the powers that be have the power to inflate the American economy much more than what they have had in the past. Both the CPI and the producer price index have been manipulated downward by almost 30%, and could be as much as 50%, depending on how you estimate it. Inflation, frankly, has been running about 8 to 10% per year. And the rate of the growth of the money supply, for example, this year has been running at about a 7% clip, sometimes spiking to as high as 12%. So this does not indicate that the powers that be want to allow a collapse at this point. Now, it has to come at some point in the future, and generally speaking, historically speaking, monetary powers have induced or allowed a recession or major depression to occur before war, and I'm predicting sometime toward the end of this decade that war will finally come home to the United States for the first time in history, will be attacked. And there may well be a major depression before that time to give a sense of isolationism to Americans, to cut military spending. That's a very real possibility. But for now, it doesn't appear that that's the way that they want to do things. I think politically what they're aiming for is that George Bush will be reelected. Kerry really is got too many flaws. This Swift Boat Veterans campaign against him, even though it's been paid for through under-the-table contributions by the Republicans, still has been very, very effective at discrediting Kerry. And he's pretty easy to discredit because he was, in fact, an anti-war activist, so it's hard for him to campaign on a I did my duty in Vietnam when he went and betrayed Vietnam after he got out of his early release. You know, he falsified some of the documents about his Purple Heart. So he really is a flawed character, much like Al Gore was. I think Bush is going to win quite handily, frankly, and I think that's what the powers that be want. But coming on down the line, I see that the Republicans don't want to, or at least the powers that be don't want to, blacken the Republicans with a depression during the next 4 years because they're planning on running Rudolph Giuliani in 2008. He's the one that will provide, or he'll be the Roosevelt of the next Third World War, in my opinion. So if they have a depression, he'll give a populist response to it in order to get reelected.
All right, fine. Well, our guest is, of course, Joel Skousen, and Joel is saying that he doesn't think there's going to be a recession, at least not for the time being. He thinks that George Bush is going to be reelected, and he thinks that the Republicans are planning on running Rudolph Giuliani in the year 2008, and, of course, he will then become the President Roosevelt of his time, or our time, leading us into a dramatic war towards the end of, at the end of this next coming decades of this decade that we're in. So with that as a background, Joel, why don't you pick the story up?
Yes. Going to the actual charges and countercharges in this campaign, I think it's interesting the very sophisticated tactics that the Republicans are using to deflect the Democratic charges against these what are called 527 groups or soft money groups. The Democrats, of course, there's about 27-some organizations been running ads on behalf of Democratic causes, and none of those have caused the Democrats to complain until the Swift Boat Veterans came out, and they're claiming, of course, that they was under-the-table funding through the Republican National Committee or other specific donors controlled by insiders within government. And I can confirm that that is true. Let's face it, there isn't any tiny veterans organization the size of the Swift Boat people, you know, numbering a few hundred people, that can mount a multi-million dollar paid advertising campaign on television. I mean, who are we kidding here? Somebody's funded that. Now, the charges happen to be true, so I'm not complaining, you know, that they got funding, but it is disingenuous for the people, Republicans, to say that they didn't have anything to do with that. You bet they had something to do with it, just as the Democrats and actually the powers that be that control both parties have ability to get on the telephone and fund any numbers of campaigns on both sides of the political spectrum. That's the essence of Hegelian conflict, is controlling both sides, still making them appear as if they're enemies. Now, this is not to say that people in the Democratic National Committee and Democratic or in Republican National Committee think that they're controlled by the same people. They don't. Most of these people really do feel they're rivals. They really do think that they have an opposition force. They work overtime to point out the weaknesses of one campaign or candidate to another. So that's not how conspiracies work. Conspiracies work by, in fact, using predictable people so that they don't have to tell them, hey, look, the game is fixed. They use predictable people who do what they want, but they're always yes men, sufficient at least, to be able to take commands when someone says, hey, call off your dogs, we're going to kill this campaign and move on to something else. They say yes, and if they start to question, someone points their finger at them and says, you know, don't ask too many questions, and they value their job, so they shut up. But what's interesting is that the way in which the Republicans have responded to the charges against George W. Bush, and these are not new charges, this has been around for years, about his womanizing, his drug use, his alcohol abuse, and his evasion of military service while he was in the National Guard. And it's been interesting to the extent of which the Republicans have attempted to defend against these charges, even to the point of saying that they're all ludicrous and all untrue. I mean, they really do claim too much, Stan. It's one thing to say some of these are untrue, but to claim that all of them are untrue just doesn't match up with the facts. But there's a very interesting one, I think, is an agent provocateur incident here, and that's this, the CBS forgeries. On 60 Minutes, Dan Rather crowed to the world about having previously undisclosed documents from Bush's former commander in the Guard, indicating that this particular commander, Jerry Killian, who died 20 years ago, had written some memos indicating that Lieutenant Bush called him to talk about getting out of some weekend drills. And there was another memo that complained, where Killian was complaining to a higher-up that he was being forced to make Bush's record look good. But interestingly, some resourceful bloggers on the Internet discovered that the proportional spacing and the font used in some of the letters or apostrophes did not match 1970s typewriters. But they do make a perfect match to a document produced by Microsoft Word on a computer. The big question is, whose forgeries were it?
In other words, it was just perhaps an agent provocateur setting up something, a straw man that you could knock down.
That's right, in order to essentially discredit the whole body of evidence against Bush, saying, look, there's forgeries out there, you can't trust any of this. And I think it's a very slick tactic.
And I think that they know exactly what they're doing. They know how to manipulate the American people. They know how to use our media. We have six major corporations that control 90% of our media. Little wonder that few Americans really understand these techniques of the enemy, be that Republican or a Democrat. They're all working towards the same identical goals. And that is, of course, the New World Order, the New World Religion. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skelton from World Affairs Brief. And, Joel, why don't you pick up the story from there, going on as far as your analysis of this campaign, which, of course, is mudslinging each candidate or their proxies, slinging mud and claiming the other person is unfit to lead.
Well, one of the biggest blockbuster things coming out this week is Kitty Kelly's book, on the family, the real story of the Bush dynasty. This thing is devastating against the Bush family. Kitty Kelly's not an unknown author. She's the biographer of the life of Nancy Reagan, mainstream publisher. Doubleday? Yes, I believe Doubleday's coming out with her new book here. Of course, advanced copies have been leaked to the New York Times and other news outlets in order to cause a great fervor here. And the Bush campaign is already trying to discredit the author and do damage control. How do they know what's coming? Well, I think it's simple. These people have vetted the president. They know all about his past. They know that he has been involved in alcohol and drug abuse, as well as womanizing, corruption in business and politics, as well as evasion of military service. And so they have these ready-made excuses that they trot out, to protect the president. As Matt Drudge reports, a representative of the White House recently called Neil Shapiro, president of NBC News, to discourage that network from broadcasting interviews with Kitty Kelly about the book on the Today Show. And, can you imagine, even on a show like Hardball with Chris Matthews, which isn't Hardball at all, but...
Maybe they ought to call it Softball, I really
think. Yeah, Softball with Chris Matthews. Anyway, the White House starts trotting out naive Republican activists to express outrage. Christine Iverson, a Republican spokeswoman, said, this book is fiction and deserves to be treated as such. Well, the same thing with Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary. He says, this book is filled with garbage that was discredited, disavowed, and dismissed years ago. He says, this is not the first time we've seen such baseless and trashy fabrications from this author. Well, in the first place, he's a well-respected author, didn't have a lot of falsifications. There was a few errors in the Nancy Reagan book. But he really shouldn't try to discredit the whole package. I mean, this really is hard to swallow when you have something as well documented as the Kitty Kelly book, and there are many alternative documentations to the Bush dynasty and their insider corruption. But one of the key accusations, Stan, is, and I think it's important in disabusing conservatives of their beliefs that the president's foibles are in the past, is Sharon Bush, the wife of former wife of Neil Bush, told Kelly in an interview that Bush used cocaine at Camp David while his father was in office. Now, Shapiro...
Well, hold that thought for just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan here, of course, our guest is Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and he's talking about Kitty Kelly's new book, an expose of the life of George Bush, and it's got a lot of things in there that are going throughout his life and many of the things he shouldn't have done in the past. But one of the things Kitty Kelly pointed out that she had been told by the former wife of Jeb Bush that George Bush had used cocaine at Camp David when his father was the President of the United States. So that would have been 1988 to 1992. So pick up the story there, Joel.
Well, now, of course, she's under pressure to recant. Sharon Bush has said, "I categorically deny that I ever told Kitty Kelly that George W. Bush used cocaine at Camp David." She also denies that she even saw him at Camp David. Of course, this was all via her lawyer, David Berg. She wouldn't swear to this, and sign her name to it. However, Doubleday, the book's publisher, part of Random House, these are very, very big establishment publishers. They stand by Miss Kelly. In fact, the publisher said in a statement to the press that an unnamed third party heard the conversation that Miss Kelly's editor, Peter Gethers, had described the same material with Miss Bush over the phone, and that Sharon Bush had not objected to it at all. In other words, even the editor had confirmed it with Sharon Bush, and now she's recanting. So obviously somebody's given her a phone call in the night, and she's running scared. But, you know, it's a very devastating book. The book examines Bush's use of obscene language in the years before taking office. As I pointed out in the World Affairs Brief a couple of weeks ago, this pattern of obscene language continues today.
Well, that is so strange for a born-again Christian to use that type of language.
Well, I think so. I think it's a real hypocritical position. Some people justify it saying, well, as long as he's not taking the name of the Lord in vain, that he's not really cursing God. But I think some of the filthy, sexually-oriented language that is used with the F word, every other word around the White House, certainly is unbecoming of the President of the United States, and it's unbecoming of any Christian to have such a foul mouth. And it's, part of it's because, you know, from a theological standpoint, we believe in a daily walk with Christ, that is, that you're supposed to have a demeanor that reflects well your Christianity. And there's also the fact that each person has a conscience. And certainly, the Lord would give one very nervous feelings about expressing language of that harshness. And so one becomes in rebellion to the promptings of God, specifically day-to-day in his daily walk. So it's not a matter of just being born again one time. One must, from I think the most sound theological point of view, really live it day-to-day.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I just so disappointed. But, you know, if you listen to the White House tapes for Richard Nixon, it was the same way. Richard Nixon, I remember, always used to go to the prayer breakfast and give these wonderful, eloquent prayers to our Lord. And then, of course, he would go back to the White House, and every other word was a swear word. And these in the White House tapes. So, you know, there's a great deal of difference between the picture, the reality of what's going on and the perception, and this is the thing that really bothers me, is that sometimes I really feel the public is being manipulated into believing somebody is what they're not.
Well, and conservatives and Christians have little defense for this, for someone pretending to be what they want. They've been a minority for so long, they've been beleaguered in the political realm for so long, that they're hungry for a true believer to step in and save them. They don't have to then work. They don't have to scrutinize. He's one of us, they say. So there's really very little defense that Christians have against someone pretending to be one of them. And it's working very well, in my opinion.
Well, I can't imagine why a Christian in the White House would be funding Planned Parenthood, taking money away from one United Nations pro-abortion organization and giving it to another United Nations pro-abortion organization and saying, see, I'm one of you. I'm anti-abortion, so I'm pro-life. So they play all sorts of games. We have more homosexuals in key positions in this administration than Bill Clinton ever would have possibly thought. And so many of the judges are being appointed to federal judgeships, lower appointments, are pro-choice. Why is the president appointing pro-choice judges into the federal court system? Well, he says the Democrats won't let me put in anybody who's pro-life, so I have to put in pro-choice judges. And you have to ask yourself, am I living in a world gone mad? Because, of course, that never bothered Bill Clinton. He put in pro-choice judges, and so is George Bush. But, of course, they're not telling the American people that.
Well, I'm convinced, relative to this latest spate of mudslinging, that, as with the life of John Kerry, they're probably a lot more about Bush. It will never see the light of day. In my opinion, it's time for sincere people of both major parties to stop voting for corrupt insiders.
You mean a Tweedledee, a Tweedledum?
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying that I think that there are some legitimate third parties. The Constitution Party and Libertarian parties are both rising to threatening status to get, break into that 10% range of the vote. And I think if they can do that in one of these elections, we'll start to see some major inroads into the Republican Party.
Well, I think that certainly is a very valid conclusion. Right now, I want you to give your telephone number. I want you to tell our listeners how they can get copies of the World Affairs Brief.
The best way for those that have access to the Internet is go to www.worldaffairsbrief.com. Lots of interesting things on my website. My two very competent researchers post their daily postings that they send to me. They post directly to the website so that you get the top stories. And I'm not talking about regular news. We're talking about the top stories that don't really get a lot of play within the Internet. And oftentimes they'll even beat Drudge Report to getting it on that site. So I know you like to use that as a resource, Stan, and many other people do too.
Well, first thing in the morning, I check up my emails, I look on Kitco to see what's happening to precious metals, and then I go to World Affairs Brief and copy three or four of your articles. You're doing a great job with that website, and I'm so glad you do the research, so I don't have to do it. It's doing great information.
Well, we do help each other,
Right.
All of us work on a shoestring budget and have limited resources and lots of volunteers to help. But the job gets done and the truth eventually gets out. And, many of the sources that I farm and work from are liberal sources because they do still have insider access, whereas true conservatives are blocked from access. So you have to learn to read between the lines. You have to learn to be able to decipher what's information and what's disinformation. But in fact, I've written a piece that is in the archives there on my website on how to analyze the news, which is interesting, about how to learn to see through and learn from what the liberal people write. Because you can tell when you look at, when they have certain media campaigns, that there's a certain direction they're pushing the American people in.
Okay, we've got one caller, and I'm going to ask if other calls just to hold off, because we really don't want to detract from what Joel has to tell us. Nathan, did you have a quick question?
Yeah, Mr. Skousen, Dr. Skousen.
Mr. Skousen.
Mr. Skousen, what's your opinion on the real locus of control in the Bush administration? I, for one, believe it's probably Cheney, but I hear a lot of, they say that the neocons, or they say that it's various theories about it. What's your take on it? I mean, I definitely believe he's skull and bones. I know that.
Fine. Well, let's see. Who is really pulling the strings in the Bush administration? Because it's certainly not George Bush.
No, George Bush, in fact, is, as I've described before, a script reader. It doesn't mean he doesn't work hard to try to memorize the script, but it's very obvious when he departs from the script that he messes up. He's not a very good person at ad-libbing. He doesn't have an in-depth background. Actually, both points of view that were made are correct. Dick Cheney is his primary handler, in my opinion. But Dick Cheney isn't running the show either. Dick Cheney is a mid-level person playing the role that Henry Kissinger did in controlling Richard Nixon. It's very interesting that up until this administration, the major controller handler of a president was the head of the National Security Advisor. But we got a lightweight in Condoleezza Rice as a National Security Advisor. She's in training, so to speak. She isn't Bush's handler. Cheney is. Donald Rumsfeld is also one of his handlers, but Cheney is the senior one and I think is calling the shots. Now, that doesn't mean that Cheney is the beginning and the end of these controllers. He's simply second level. We really don't know who are first level. We know the neocons are part of the staff team that provide all of the backup information, the strategy that Rumsfeld and Cheney then point to the hand out to the president. So both are integral parts. The neocons are an integral part as well as a specific handler who Bush trusts and who is savvy enough to control the president without, how to say, making him look like a fool. I mean, these people really are president. They think that they do have power. They have to be treated with some respect and care. And so the handlers do keep feeding them the information. But I think George Bush knows that if he really bucked the line, that he would be in trouble and could be removed out of office. He clearly knows that these people put him into power and can take him out of power.
Well, you know, one of the things that really has intrigued me is why did the Project for the New American Century put up a website, its own website, newamericancentury.org, where anybody can go and read their plans and figure out exactly what they're doing. And, you know, I puzzled over that for a long time until I suddenly came to the conclusion that they want everybody to think that they are the ultimate source of authority, that they're the ones who are behind everything that's going on. I think they're simply a cog in this wheel, and as you point out, there are people far higher than that manipulating not the Project for the New American Century and everything else, but that what our attention is being drawn to that, and a lot of good conservatives say, well, this then is the seat of power. If it were the seat of power, they wouldn't have a website up there.
That's very true. The real powers that be stay hidden behind the scenes.
Okay, I hope that answers your question, Nathan.
Well, I agree. And very quickly, one more thing.
I want to get the rest.
That's all right. Let him go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, my next question is, do you think that George Bush is being punished for having deviated from the script in one profound respect? Was when he said that in prayer, in going to war, he wants to speak to the Heavenly Father and not his earthly father, and then in the bloodlines, that's considered to be treason.
Right.
I'll take my as a possibility, if that's true, I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I'm not. Could you understand the question?
Yes. I'm. You know, that was disturbing to a lot of non-religious people. It was disturbing to me that someone as shallow in his religiosity as George Bush would make it appear as if God was speaking to him, that he had a mission to go to war, etc. I think, frankly, that he isn't being punished for that. I think that was, in fact, a carefully tutored remark. There is a whole body of evidence that indicates that the powers that be have set up Christians to be ridiculed in the name of George Bush. In other words, there's these National Public Radio or, what is it,
NPR?
Public broadcasting things on the faith of the president that really, put out Bush as a strong manipulative Christian, and I think it did more damage, frankly, to the Christian cause to have this shallow representative expressing those kinds of things. And it certainly welded, it was meant also to weld the Christians and conservatives more to Bush. But you see, this is a major propaganda piece. So when Bush comes out of his way to make outlandish religiosity statements when we know he isn't really religious, he is either going specifically to target the conservatives or to, that is, to keep their loyalty, or it's to discredit Christianity, which I think it does a little bit of both in each of those cases. I know that every time that there's something, like in my World Affairs brief, when I talked about his obscenity and his control of the press, when he walked off the stage, remember when one of the journalists asked him an embarrassing question, he got mad and walked off the stage and said, you know, why didn't somebody control that MF-er, and said some expletives about him. He says, you know, if you can't control him, I'll get somebody who will. All that indicated that the president knew that they could control journalists. But immediately, you know, my brother, for example, took my World Affairs brief to his friends at Council for National Policy. This is the Bush cheerleader club on the conservative side. And he was amazed at how many quickly came and says, well, I've been in the White House and I've never heard George Bush, use a swear word, or I've been in the White House and he has prayed with me and he has told me spiritual experiences. You know, I think that these White House controllers know when these conservatives are coming. They particularly prey on these naive and willing conservatives and Christians, bring them into the White House, stroke them, give them these pseudo-spiritual experiences so that they can go away as true believers and vouch for George Bush. And they haul these people out in front of the press every time one of us conservatives criticizes the president as not being truly Christian. So this is a very sophisticated game that they're playing.
And it is a game. This is my fear. This was the same game that Richard Nixon played of being this devout Christian. And yet, of course, he lied consistently to the American people. Every other word was a swear word. He betrayed the boys in Vietnam. He kept that war going for 4 years so he could get reelected, and then abandoned thousands of men that he knew to a life of hopelessness there, telling the American people all the men were home. When he later admitted to Captain Red McDaniels that he knew he left them behind, and he was going to get them, but then Watergate came along, and there was nothing he could do. So he was a totally hypocritical, a very evil man, in my estimation, and yet he poses this great Christian president. But that's what the American people want. They want to believe in their leaders. They want to believe they're just what they appear to be. Unfortunately, sometimes that's not true.
I think Richard Nixon actually started out as a legitimate conservative. He was quite sincere in his prosecution of Alger Hiss. In fact, the establishment powers never forgave him for that. But as he got higher into politics, he had to make increasing compromises of his principles in order to get higher into office. No one gets into high office today without compromise of principle. It's very obvious as I tracked the career of Richard Nixon that at some point when he realized that there were powers that be who had absolute control over the higher offices of government and he had to kowtow to those people, he decided to bend over backwards, do whatever it took to meet their approval. And then they betrayed him. I think that they delighted in pulling the rug out from Richard Nixon to show him kind of like, you thought you could get into our club by ingratiating yourself and by compromising your principle. And even after they betrayed him in Watergate, I mean, you and I both know that both parties have been spying on one another. And by the way, that may not have been the real reason for Watergate. There was probably some other theories about why those burglars were there. But nevertheless, the point is that Richard Nixon bent over backwards for the rest of his life, even after the presidency, in order to ingratiate himself into the powers that be and run around internationally promoting their agenda.
And, of course, then they, after totally humiliating him, then they rejuvenated him. They brought him back, and suddenly at the time he died, he was once again accepted by the establishment. It's amazing how they can create people and destroy them, create them, destroy them, and then create them once again. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up our program with our special guest, Joel Skousen. Well, Joel, we've got about 3 minutes before we have to let you go. What would you like to talk about?
Well, the final subject is the pressure is heating up on Syria. Once again, the neocons are beating the drums on Iran and Syria. Michael Adeen is figuring very prominently. He's really one of those neocons who's probably taken a less public profile than people like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle. But he's every bit as much a powerful insider. He's a very strong Machiavellian. In fact, he's written books on Machiavelli and modern leadership, why Machiavelli's iron rules are as timely and important today. This person is a real pragmatist. He talks about total war. Remember, total war was the satanic doctrine that Hitler developed. It's one that Roosevelt and Churchill took up in their annihilation of Germany, not refusing to accept any surrender by the German military. These are very, very evil doctrines that indicate that they want conflict. He's a very strong exponent of Hegelian conflict. And so it's no surprise that when he talks about we're going to have to focus on Syria and Iran now that he is confirming that those are going to be the next target of the United States in the Middle Eastern war. And
of course, they can't tell the American people that. They think that we're going to be out of this mess in a year or two. They don't understand this is going to go on and on, and if we get into a war with Iran, we're going to be in real trouble.
Well, that's right, and Syria, of course, has got the largest concentration of weapons in the Near East, you know, surrounding Israel. They are the most formidable, you know, threat right now, especially when you consider Iran and Syria are backing the Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's part of the pressure now that's being put upon, and Lebanon may be the key trigger here. There's a trigger in Iran, too, you know, their nuclear program. If Israel pulls a preemptive strike, which I have no doubt they will at some time in the future, this could certainly trigger another war because Iran does have missiles and has threatened to use them against Israel, loaded with biological or chemical weapons. So the trigger on Iran is their nuclear program. The trigger on Syria will be Lebanon and its continued control of Syria. Last week, Lebanese parliament changed the constitution to allow Prime Minister Lahoud, a puppet of Syria, to continue in office, and this week he suddenly says, I'm going to resign. But that's probably only to deflect criticism. He's got another puppet who will rise in the state to get reelected, and he'll continue on as before.
Joel, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to talking to you later this week on one of the other programs.
All right, my pleasure.
Thank you so very much. And our guest has been Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. You need to get his material, and you need to read it, and you need to study it. You're going to be able to keep on top of what's really happening. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly Joel is one of my favorite guests. I hope you enjoy him as much as I do, but I think it's so important that we have other sources of information. The media is controlled by six major corporations. We're just reading the book on the media elite by Ben Bachmachian, I believe that's his name. He started back in 1980 doing research on who controls the media. At that time, there were 50 corporations. As of 2000, when he wrote the sixth edition of his book, there were six major corporations that control about 90% of the media here in the United States. And you must understand that they control and affect what the American people think. So this is why I do what I do, and if you would like to help me as we reach out across America, we have about 60 different outlets every week now that carry one part of our programming, including satellite and internet and very shortwave. We actually have three shortwave outlets now every day, but it's an expensive proposition, let me tell you. And so even the ISDN lines that we have to buy are expensive, so we can have studio quality voice coming to you over the airwaves. If you believe there's a problem, you'd like to become part of our family, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We could certainly use your help and your support as we reach out across America, trying to educate the American people, to explain that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on the political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational battlefield. Everything is spiritual. There really are secret societies working behind the scenes, and we, of course, name many of them in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not yet read it, you should get it. Or you can get the Brotherhood of Darkness special with the book, the video, and the audio tape. And we encourage you to copy the video and the audio tape or anything else we've produced. As long as you're not making a profit on it, we want you to help get that information out across America. So our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, that's the August newsletter, which tells what Alan Greenspan and Warren Buffett really think about what's going on. Why, give us a call. And Warren Greenspan is, pardon me, Warren Buffett is not in the least bit optimistic about the future of the American economy, as you'll learn from his own words. And so that we'll be glad to send you a free copy of my newsletter. And we hope many of you will want to get some of the material we have on what's going on behind the scenes from an occult point of view. The video, they sold their souls for rock and roll. You can get the 4-hour or the 10-hour version of that. That's they sold their souls for rock and roll. The book Fallen Angel goes into Led Zeppelin, and of course their most popular album of all time, Stairway to Heaven, which is all about Satan. And this is really what it's all about. We have a four tapes out on Aleister Crowley. He was the leading Satanist of the first half of the last century. And his ideas, his concepts are being taught in our schools. Yes, even in some of our churches today. You need to get our four tapes out on Aleister Crowley. You need to get our four tapes set on the church growth movement. You need to get our four tapes set on Satanism and deliverance, or the four tapes set on the apostate church. You need to get our video diapracts in the church. You need to get the four tapes set, the wisdom of Malachi Martin. And I realize there are a lot of things here. Remember the video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Remember the four tapes set on the church growth movement, the apostate church, Aleister Crowley and his friends, and certainly the wisdom of Malachi Martin. Just to give you a few of the things that we have, of course, we have things on the secret government, on secret societies. You'll get one of our catalogs. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. Consider coming to our November 6th all-day meeting here in Santa Cruz at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. You'll have to call ahead of time at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.